I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest on Two Jewish is Yaron Shavit, deputy chair of the executive of the Jewish Agency. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the Sunday of 4th of July weekend, and that makes this a good time to remember the role that we Jews played in the American Revolution back in 1776, and the 7 years of the long American War of Independence that created our country. That's nearly 250 years ago. We could, of course, extend this discussion throughout the rest of American history, but as long as we're on the subject of the 4th of July...
He died while cutting velvet. On a hot July the 4th. But his cloth goes shining on.
Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry. His cloth goes shining on.
Oh, Harry Lewis perished. In the service of his Lord, he was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of wrath are stored. He had the finest funeral the Union could afford, and his cloth goes shining on.
Playing us in this morning, that was the late, great comedian Alan Sherman's incredible The Ballad of Harry Lewis, including one of the greatest puns in the history of musical parody. He was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of wrath are stored. Funny take on American patriotism viewed through the lens, or maybe the curtains, of the Jewish prevalence in the garment industry, just one place we have made a big impact. Back to the deep, positive involvement of Jews in the earliest stages of American history, the Revolutionary War, and the creation of the United States. In a way, this seems like a really important subject to reflect on now. We Jews have long viewed America as a unique nation of opportunity that guaranteed religious freedom from its founding, and we have flourished here in the U.S. as much as we ever have in any nation during our long, long history as a people. After suffering religious persecution at the hands of governments all over the world for literally thousands of years, it has been our privilege to enjoy true religious freedom here in America. We have been blessed by the ability to create thriving, vibrant Jewish life in the U.S. from colonial times to today. America has truly been a golden land of acceptance and opportunity for Jews in so many ways for such a long time. But lately, there has been a dramatic, ugly rise in anti-Semitic activity all over our country, And while this has been coming on for quite a while, I look back, realizing that I have been warning and talking about this for much more than 5 years right here on Too Jewish. Well, since October 7, 2023, of course, the anti-Semitism has deeply intensified, particularly on the progressive side of politics. Look, violence against Jews, which used to be the province of the extreme fanatical right side of American politics, the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Nation, and other true believers in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and of course the George Soros runs everything in the world crazies, well, they're still around, but it is now the left that has fallen into the arms of the terrorist-supporting, Israel-hating, racist, anti-Semitic, violent conspiracy theory-spouting Arab-funded whack jobs. And violence is always readily available at their hands. The truth is, America has been a fantastic place for Jews throughout most of its history, and we've enjoyed a true golden age here for decades. But the underlying insecurity that has lingered for many of us, just how fully accepted are we as Jews really here? Is there a latent danger even in this golden Medina, this remarkable nation? Those fears are now activated by quite real persecutions taking place today, especially of young Jews on college campuses, but on the streets of New York and Los Angeles and many other places too. I thought about this, reflecting on the fact that no, there is no Father Coughlin today broadcasting anti-Semitism to a large, enthusiastic audience. And no, Henry Ford isn't publishing the virulently anti-Semitic conspiracy fiction of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to a wide and approving circulation. There aren't many restricted neighborhoods left in America today. We Jews have risen to the top of nearly every profession. But we should be troubled by what is going on now nonetheless, feeling grateful that there has been significant pushback against the rising tide of anti-Semitism, and we should seek to support that pushback. Still, it's a challenging time. All of which reminds me of a favorite shtick about the insecurity of being Jewish in America. Here's comedian Robert Klein, a past guest of Too Jewish, of course, reflecting some of that experience from his own childhood in the 1950s.
I remember once the kid who carried the American flag dropped it by accident. He tripped. I assume it was an accident. Who knows? Maybe a communist stuck his foot out. You know. Tripped him. Yeah, they do that. You know, they send their kids and they go into the thing, trip them, yay, mao. They give the signal. And they give the special communist handshake. But the kid dropped the American flag. And it blew his mind, because they imbued the flag with a special power beyond itself, like, you know, no, he started to bend down and kiss the little gold fringes on the side, those little titsis things, you know what I'm saying? The kid, under the approving eye of an adult teacher, that's it, kiss the broadcloth, very nice, you know. Give it a nice kiss, that'll make everything all better, you know. Children fantasize, something like George Washington's gonna pop out, hey, you'll drop me! After all I suffered at Valley Forge, you little Jew boy!
I don't think it's necessarily the end of our golden age here in America. I do have great faith in the resilience of democracy and American decency, even at times like now of challenge and trouble. I just wish that I could report at the end of this 4th of July weekend that things are improving here for Jews. They have certainly been worse at times in the past, but it wasn't long ago when they seemed better. May we return to those days speedily and soon. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Yaron Shavit, the deputy chair of the executive of the Jewish Agency, a primary organization in Israel and, frankly, for the whole Jewish world, find out what the Jewish Agency does in 2024, just how important it is, and the challenges it faces now when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort? As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners.
with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are honored to welcome the Two Jewish, Yaron Shavit. He's deputy chair of the executive of the Jewish Agency for Israel, one of the, I think, most important and least understood major Jewish players in the world. He's speaking to us from Israel right now. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Tell us, what is the Jewish Agency in 2024?
So the Jewish Agency in 2024 is actually the largest organization, Jewish organization, that the Israeli society and the wider Jewish world through a joint table. Its mission is to actually deal with three missions that the Zionist movement that the Jewish Agency is a part of put on the Jewish Agency's shoulders. So the first assignment is to do Aliyah. Anything that has to do with making Aliyah to Israel is under the responsibility and the jurisdiction of the Jewish Agency, and it's part of our commitment and living up to the words in the Declaration of Independence that the State of Israel will be open for Jewish Aliyah for all Jews around the world. The other field of influence is, again, influenced by a mission that we received from the Zionist movement, and that is to have an exemplary society. So within the State of Israel and the Israeli society, the Jewish Agency, through the funding of the Jewish world, helps the weaker parts of Israeli society in the periphery, elderly age and disabilities and kids who need assistance and stuff like that. So that's the second mission. And the third mission is called Connect. We take upon ourselves the mission of connecting Jews to Judaism around the world, to other Jews around the world, and to the State of Israel. There are three different layers of Connect that the Jewish Agency is involved in. That is basically what we do.
I'll take kind of each of those separately, most of them later in the show, but I want to note that in the period since the Ukraine war began, I know that Aliyah from that part of the world has risen. Has that been affected since October 7th? Has that been limited by the war in Gaza?
Yes, directly and indirectly. So the when the war wasn't even a war, when the invasion, if we can call it that, from Russia to Ukraine started, there was a flood of Jewish and non-Jewish refugees from Ukraine. Some of them came to Israel as a stop to make Aliyah or to decide if they want to make Aliyah, and some of them did make Aliyah. There was also, when the Iron Curtain sort of started closing down, there was an increase in Aliyah from Russia. That has almost completely stopped since October 7th. There is lower numbers of Aliyah from Russia, but there is an increase in the numbers of Aliyah from the West and from North America. It's interesting.
Very interesting. We will talk much more with Yaron Shavit, Deputy Chair of the Executive of the Jewish Agency for Israel. We come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a marvelous array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established, well, closing in on 6 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. 520-276-5675. Our phone number is 520-276-5675. Religious school registration is available now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting for every age of learner with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m., followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat with homemade challah every week. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can come in person or go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. Our musical services are in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live and on Zoom, and there are many of them. You can find those at our website, BeitSimchaTucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store, a very popular podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are a big help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We began speaking last week, talked pretty extensively about the recent elections, the rise of the far right in particular, and we just kind of began to touch on it, but we were talking about France. And then more globally, you cited two crucial elements. One, the rise of autocrats, many parts of the world, Turkey, China, Hungary, etc., and of course Russia. The second element is this rise of far-right parties, which you would think Europe had learned its lesson about fascism in 1945. What's going on now?
It's a very complicated, multidimensional question, but I think that at the risk of gross oversimplification, it's safe to say that the past few decades have, and certainly the past, let's say, half century since World War II.
And I hate to mention this, but it's
now
more than half a century since World War II.
Right. But there's been an unprecedented rate of social change, changes in society, changes in norms, changes in the way we communicate. I mean, 50 years ago, nobody heard of a cell phone. Nobody had heard of Facebook or any of the stuff that is now universally, and in many countries, much more than in our own country. This is core to the culture. Along with that have been unprecedented rises in immigration, sometimes for political reasons, sometimes for economic reasons. I mean, we can see this in our own country. Immigration is a major issue for many people, or at least it's being turned into a major issue for the upcoming presidential elections. And that is true all over Europe. People are watching their country and their notion of what society should be like change with almost unprecedented rapidity. I mean, the last time stuff like this happened was the Industrial Revolution, and which led to mass urbanization and the growth of really huge cities. That was centuries ago. And now, it's, if anything, it's an IT, both information and technology revolution. But I think it's causing great social stress, and not only in our country, but around the world, increasingly wide and increasingly intolerable differences in income levels and a perceived sense of well-being and economic security. And I think when people are insecure and made to feel uncomfortable by rapid social change and by growing disparities between the rich and poor, they historically tend to flock to right-wing parties that claim to have all the answers, that oversimplify things, that identify one enemy and say, if we only exterminate, for example, all the Jews in Europe in the late 30s and early 40s, then all these problems will go away.
You know, there's a phrase, those of us who are history buffs, called the Age of Anxiety. And although Auden used it for a poem, it's actually a historical kind of truism that in certain periods when there are all kinds of dramatic changes, technological, geographic, perception, and certainly financial, people act in ways that you just don't expect building up to that period. And then all of a sudden, everything kind of comes together and things change dramatically. I'm concerned that, and I think all of us are probably a little concerned about this, turn to simple answers and populist expressions that may or may not have anything to do with solutions, but provide some kind of psychological support, perhaps, for people.
Right. And historically, these parties and these types of leaders, and we can see this today as well, tend to foster and or embrace anti-Semitism in sometimes in crude and dangerous ways. And I think the rise in anti-Semitism around the world, again, not limited by any means to our own country, is evidence of this trend, and they're linked. I mean, the trend towards the far right and towards looking for easy answers and finding a scapegoat for all society's ills, that never ends well for Jews.
No, but we're seeing it on the far left as well, of course, too. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A New York judge is presiding over the divorce proceedings for a Jewish couple. When the final papers are signed, the divorce is complete. The woman thanks the judge and says, "Now I have to arrange for a get." The judge asks what she means by a get. The woman explains a get is a Jewish religious ceremony required under Judaism in order to receive a divorce. The judge says, "You mean it's a religious ceremony like a bris, a circumcision?" And the woman replies, "Yes, very similar. Only in this case, you get rid of the entire schmuck." You see, schmuck means, well, if you don't know that, never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in the book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ashes, and mix the ashes with water, creating a liquid of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements of the sacrificial code of our distant ancestors seem odd or even alien, this might be the strangest of all the rituals. For it turns out that the red heifer, the Para Aduma, makes the person who is washed in its ash water pure. But it makes everybody else who comes into contact with that special water impure. The mystery is complete. Commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the Torah was given. What is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the Israelite people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but simultaneously make you impure while you are properly preparing it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer, this female cow, as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. Since the people of Israel sinned by bowing down and praying to the idol of a calf, the slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might atone for that transgression. But why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually make us unclean? Perhaps the answer, too, is symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never easy. Working in the field of holiness creation is not simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that always exists in the world to attach itself to you. When we seek to bring purity into the lives of others, we stand a pretty good chance of exchanging some of our own innate sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists all over existence. The complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow, like the red heifer, symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, and learn to cleanse ourselves ritually, and perhaps psychically afterwards, we replenish our ability to help and heal others. This can be true of those engaged in ritual healing, of course, but for those engaged in assisting the damaged and broken among us to find greater wholeness, well, it's true in any field of endeavor. It's just as true for psychologists, social workers, physicians, and nurses, for counselors and teachers, indeed for anyone occupied with working to help heal the broken in the world. You know, even rabbis. First, we work to heal. Then we must work to heal ourselves so that we may continue to help others. When we come back in a moment, our guest, Yaron Shavit, deputy chair of the executive of the Jewish Agency, fills us in on its important work at this crucial time for Israel and updates us on the status of the reform movement in Israel right now. Yaron Shavit rejoins us when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's two chief rabbis stepped down from their posts last week, leaving the positions officially vacant for the first time in more than a century, as the government failed to set a date for their successors' election. Two rabbis stepped in to fill the job's duties on an interim basis, but who the next Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbis of Israel will be and when they will be chosen, that's up in the air. The two outgoing rabbis, Ashkenazi chief rabbi David Lau and Sephardic chief rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, were elected back in 2013, each to a 10-year term by a body of approximately 150 people, mostly rabbis. These chief rabbis sit atop the vast bureaucracy of the ultra-Orthodox-controlled Israeli chief rabbinate, which manages broad swaths of religious life in Israel, including marriage, burial, and conversion. The chief rabbis hold little power over the day-to-day operations of the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate. That's run by a council, but they traditionally command influence in Israeli public religious discourse. At this hour, the term of the chief rabbis is ending, said Michael Malkieli, Israel's religious affairs minister. It was a term full of complex challenges during which they led the citizens of Israel with bravery and courage. What Malkieli's post did not include was when the new election will take place. A scheduling conflict and concerns regarding the makeup of the voting body mean that this religious ministry has repeatedly postponed a vote that was supposed to take place in 2023. First, the rabbinate election clashed with Israel's local elections. Okay, reschedule. But the date was pushed off again because of two rulings from Israel's Supreme Court. Both Rabbi Lau and Rabbi Yosef come from rabbinical dynasties, and the court ruled that because both have brothers running to replace them, the chief rabbis themselves could not have a hand in choosing members of the voting body that chooses the successors. The second ruling instructed them to consider appointing more women to the voting body. Didn't know that there were any, to be honest. Now, multiple petitions to the Israeli Supreme Court are demanding the court order the government to immediately schedule elections. By law, they were supposed to have happened, well, last year. One of the petitioners is Itim, the organization that helps Israelis navigate the rabbinate's, boy, painful bureaucracy, and advocates for better governance in the body. At present, the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate, has power and needs to be transparent, said Rabbi Seth Farber, the founder of Itim, a past guest of Two Jewish, and the recipient of the Kohan Foundation Memorial Award for service to the whole Jewish people not long ago. Right now, said Rabbi Farber, the rabbinate is violating the law by not holding elections. We want to stop this mishigas once and for all. If the new rabbinate is not willing to work with us, we will work hard to limit their powers. There have been attempts to change the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate, via elections in the past. Back in 2013, in the last election, a reformist candidate, religious Zionist Rabbi David Stav, ran a high-profile campaign but fell short in the vote. This year, the relatives of Rabbis David and Yosef, both of whose fathers also were chief rabbis, hope to keep the positions, you know, in the family. Criticism of the chief rabbinate is widespread among Israeli Jews, spanning secular Jews who chafe at its often insane religious restrictions, and Haredi, ultra-Orthodox Jews who want it to be even more stringent, or who criticize the fact that it's affiliated with Israeli government at all. According to a survey conducted about 6 weeks ago by the Israel Democracy Institute, only 44% of Israeli Jews say they accept the chief rabbinate of Israel as a religious or spiritual authority. That includes 66% of Haredi, ultra-Orthodox respondents, and just 17% of secular Jews. The rabbinate's highest rating, 78%, comes from religious Zionists. And now, there are no chief rabbis in Israel, not Ashkenazic, not Sephardic. Why? Because of politics. Imagine that. In Washington, D.C., the Anti-Defamation League's legal team is joining a top-ranked American legal firm to seek compensation for U.S. victims of the October 7th Hamas atrocities in Israel. This will be the latest of multiple lawsuits in the U.S. targeting entities that lawyers say abetted or profited from those atrocities. The lawsuit filed last week by the ADL and the Kroll and Mooring law firm accuses Iran, Syria, and North Korea of abetting the Palestinian terrorists who murdered over 1,200 people on October 7th and wounded thousands more in addition to abducting more than 250 people. The plaintiffs seek compensation under a 2015 law in the U.S. meant to compensate victims of state-sponsored terrorism through criminal penalties and seized assets. Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of anti-Semitism and terror, along with Syria and North Korea. They must be held responsible for their roles in the largest anti-Semitic attack since the Holocaust, said Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, another past guest of Two Jewish. It's about finding justice for the victims and their families, putting all the weight behind this case, because what we're talking about is the largest and most deadly and systematic attack since the Holocaust, said James Pash, the lead ADL counsel in the case. The world should know who is responsible for providing support for this heinous terrorist attack and hear the stories of the victims and the families of the victims. Iran funds and trains Hamas. The terrorist group's leaders have for decades had close dealings with Syria's Assad regime. Lawyers say they will produce evidence that those two countries and North Korea provided material support to the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists carrying out the October 7th brutalities. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. The 2015 law requires fines levied on state sponsors of terrorism to be streamed into a fund for the victims. Federal government in recent years has directed just a fraction of the money obtained from such fines into the fund. Lawyers are simultaneously working with a bipartisan slate of lawmakers in both chambers of Congress to pass a law that will tighten that measure, ensuring a substantial portion of the monies reach the victims' fund. The bill's sponsors include Democratic Reps Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, Dan Goldman of New York, and Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal. Other sponsors include New York Republican Reps Mike Lawler and Nicole Malliotakis, and Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn. There should be ample funds available. Last November, $4 billion was exacted from cryptocurrency fund Binance and its CEO for dealing illegally with Iran and Syria. The lawsuit is the latest in a number of high-profile attempts to get civil relief in U.S. courts for victims of the October 7th attack. Applying a variety of legal strategies, this case is notable because it includes Kroll and Mooring, consistently ranked high among the top-earning law firms in the nation. It employs dozens of former federal government officials. Each of the more than 100 plaintiffs in this suit is a U.S. citizen or a family member of a U.S. citizen, is therefore eligible to bring suit for the deaths, physical and emotional injuries, and hostage takings Hamas caused during its barbaric rampage, the ADL said. The ADL quoted Nahar Netta, the son of Adrienne Netta, a U.S.-born midwife who was murdered by Palestinian terrorists on October 7th. My mom devoted her life to caring for others regardless of race or religious beliefs. She was a peace and justice seeker, active in many civilian efforts to bridge the gap between Jews and Arabs in Israel. And in other news, vandals in Cincinnati damaged or knocked over 176 gravestones at two historic Jewish cemeteries last week. A joint statement from the local Jewish Federation, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Jewish Cemeteries of Greater Cincinnati called it an act of anti-Semitic vandalism, which is what it was. Most of the graves were pushed face down, which Jewish groups said made it difficult to identify and notify the families. Local law enforcement insisted they leave the scene untouched while they investigate. We are deeply saddened and outraged to report that 176 gravestones were vandalized at the Tiferet Israel Cemetery and the Beit HaMidrash HaGadol Cemetery. Both cemeteries are part of a larger complex on Cincinnati's historic west side, the group said. The incident was the latest in a long line of anti-Semitic acts targeting Jewish cemeteries. Some of the targeted gravestones in Cincinnati date back to the 1800s. Many were cracked by these acts of vandalism. Local and federal law enforcement are involved in the investigation. As we have frequently noted on Too Jewish, anti-Semitism has been a growing concern for Jews nationwide, especially since the start of the current Israel-Hamas war. Synagogues, Holocaust museums, and Jewish day schools have all become targets for hateful acts by anti-Semites. But Jewish cemeteries have been a consistent target of anti-Semitic vandalism for many centuries. After all, that's an easy target for cowards. Headstones don't fight back. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Yaron Shavit. He's deputy chair of the executive for the Jewish Agency for Israel. Now, I should note, as important as the work for the Jewish Agency goes, that's not your actual profession.
That's true. I've been sent as an emissary of the Reform Movement, as the representative of our movement, to participate first as a layperson since 2008 in the around the table of the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency. And since the last 3 years, I've been asked to take the position of the deputy chair and close altogether my law firm and my clientele and everything. That's true.
And we'll come back to talk about the Reform Movement in Israel, because it's also a very interesting subject. But let's talk about the needs of underprivileged Jews in Israel, which obviously is a crucial aspect of Jewish Agency work, as you delineated earlier. The impact of the war must be profound.
No doubt. But to be honest, and this has to be mentioned to the large extent and warmth of world Jewry, the support has increased in hundreds of millions of dollars to assist Israeli society, and within that, the Jewish Agency and other Israeli institutions. The needed first in hardware, I call it. We immediately needed to help Israeli society regain its self-confidence and its ability to defend itself after the terrible nightmare of what happened in October 7th, when our western Negev kibbutzim, moshavim, and small towns were attacked, and the help took time coming in, and it was a complete disarray, and people lost their self-confidence, and we needed to get simple equipment to build back our confidence. Now, after some time of dealing with that, it's obvious that we need to deal with, quote-unquote, the software, the resilience, the psychological, social workers. The need for all of this has increased in thousands of people immediately since October 7th, and the war, and of course now injuries. So yes, it's both the hardware and the software.
Well, I guess the other question is, where does the Jewish Agency get its resources to help apply to these obvious needs?
From the Jewish world, basically, to be honest, a large extent to North America. JFNA, Jewish Federations of North America, are a part of the forces that are around the round table of the Jewish Agency, and they fundraise in North America. And around the rest of the world, the body that is known as Keren Hayesod is fundraising for the Jewish Agency to support us in the needs that we're covering from within Israeli society.
The impact of the work that has been necessary since October 7th, it's still evolving. It's not entirely clear all of the things that are going to happen, because we don't know how long this war is going to last. How do you prepare for in an uncertain situation like this?
So we have to be aware of the fact that, the unfortunate fact, that the biggest body that is supposed to take the mission of supporting the Israeli society, which is the government of Israel, is still very late and very lacking involvement. And there, the Jewish Agency, as again the biggest, the largest organization, but also individual and organizations within Israeli society and organizations from around the Jewish organizations from around the world, also are involved in taking the mission of supporting the Israeli society, because again, the government is very weak, unfortunately. Having said that, we prepare ourselves. We know that when a need arises, the good nature of Jews around the world is to open the pocket, open their hearts, and raise money. But we also realize the fact that as time passes, the willingness and the way sort of falls and diminishes within time. It happened also with the assistance to the situation, the crisis in Ukraine. So a lot of the money that is being raised has not been spent. We are taking good care of managing the expenditure of the money that was raised to make sure that we meet the needs that we understand will still be coming. We are preparing for a period of between 3 to 5 years of rebuilding both the infrastructure and the communities. Again, what I call the hardware and the software.
Tell us about the Reform Movement in Israel, which you have been so active in for so long. It has grown tremendously. I remember, years ago, people saying, well, you know, nobody knows what Reform Judaism is in Israel. That's not so true anymore, is it?
I think that more and more Israelis like myself that were not raised Reform find their Jewish life and Judaism and performing their commitment to Judaism through the Reform movement as the actual answer for us to be forthcoming between our non-Orthodox way of life, nevertheless our willingness to be connected and to educate our children and their and our grandchildren now in a way that connects them to Judaism, but not feeling that they need to sort of be untrue to themselves by going into an Orthodox synagogue and feeling that they're out of place. So we feel very much at home through the Reform congregations that we are building within our towns, cities, and now kibbutzim and moshavim, by the way, including the areas that are in the western Negev. We have a congregation and a rabbi in the northern part of Israel that are evacuated in Nahariya. That people are evacuated, our rabbis and our congregants are dealing with the challenges of the current situation. And the fact that the Israel movement has, the IMPJ, the Israel Reform Movement, has increased so in such big numbers is very much, I at least think, is very much part of the willingness of HUC to the Hebrew Union College, its campus in Jerusalem, to educate rabbis and rabbis who are Israelis, who were born Israelis, who speak Hebrew as Israelis, who once ordained and once going out to the Israeli public are accepted by Israelis as part of Israeli society and not as part of something that is coming as an import from abroad.
From America, right, or England. Right?
From America, mainly. And therefore, I think the fact that we now have more than 115 Israeli-born and raised rabbis ordained in Israel by the Reform Movement, the biggest contribution and the force that moves us forward to build more congregations, to expose more Israelis who did not grow up as Reforms to know what the Reform Movement is through performing weddings, through having chagim in an environment which is accepting, which is egalitarian, which accepts women completely as equals, and that, of course, works to our favor.
I confess, when I was in rabbinical school, not quite 1,000 years ago, a friend of mine, Bill Daniel, Alav HaShalom, invited me to come down for the dedication of a new building, Beit Daniel, that he and his brother had paid for, and it was a big empty building. I mean, nobody knew if it was going to work. Obviously, it's been an engine for the growth of Reform in Tel Aviv and has contributed in many interesting ways.
You should come on Shabbat and see that this institution under the very skillful hands of Rabbi Meir Azari.
Yeah, Meir Azari has been incredible. A past guest of Too Jewish, I might add.
So you should see that they're having, I think, more... sometimes 3, 4, 5 bar mitzvahs,
right,
and bat mitzvah,
yeah,
at the same Shabbat. It's fantastic.
It is amazing to see that growth. This is a tricky time for anybody involved in, as you note, connecting people to Israel. What are the challenges that the Jewish Agency in particular has had to address in the course of these last 9 months of the Gaza War and all of the challenges that it has brought?
I think the biggest challenge that, and I personally am now trying to put my energy on that after doing what I did for the first few months after the war with bringing equipment. Now I see the biggest challenge is connecting young adults from North America to young adults in Israel. I feel that the chasm that is being deepened and increased so deeply and widely in the last few months is a strategic challenge for the Jewish world and for the relations and the existence of the state of Israel yet to come. If we lose the support of voters and influencers within the American society in 20 years from now simply because they just turn back and their backs on Israel, I think it will be catastrophic. for all of us, by the way, not only for Israel and Israelis, for the entire Jewish world. So I think this is the biggest challenge.
It's, I think, not only a challenge for the Jewish agency, it's a challenge, as you note, for everybody in the Jewish world. It's a challenge we face in North America as well. If you were going to ask people around the world what they can do that's most important for the thriving of Judaism in Israel now, what would it be?
It would be simply to remember, and that is what I try to do when I travel, is to remember that the state of Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people, the entire Jewish people, not only the Israelis. And it's so critical these days, even during the crisis that we had regarding liberal democracy just before October 7th, and even much more today, that you speak up and stand up for liberal Judaism within Israel and support the Israelis who have share the same values as you do around the world, and make sure that you don't walk away from us, because we're in the trenches, and it's obvious that there's a battle here between different ideologies for the future of the Jewish people. And if liberal, reform, open-minded Jews around the world will not stand up for their supporters within the Israeli society, it might be an awful outcome. So we really need you to stand up for us.
Thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about the Jewish Agency and its work?
I think simply just click Jewish Agency in Google or any other search engine that you have. You will come to our website and you will find a lot of information and ways of contact to the Jewish Agency.
Thank you so much. And Kol Tiv, keep doing this great work that you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guests will be Ruth Finkel-Wade and Joy Ensor, second-generation survivors, talking about their terrific new book, The Ones Who Remember. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha, where the air conditioning is fantastic. Every Friday night, services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person, and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes for the end of our 4th of July holiday weekend. It's a favorite recording, Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Paul Simon's great song about America, American Tune. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good end of this 4th of July weekend, and a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Ich bin weiß, kein Mutschit nur. Wer schricht sich aber, es soll lustig, freudig sein, as I in Gaulis go, as I in Gaulis go. Seinen meine Bekannte alle zermisst. Ich hab kein Freund, was geht im Feuer. Weiß mir auch allem, was ist nicht und siehst. Von Keulisch geworden Feuer, nur gut ist es, gut als euch. Azoi lang heigle. Nu ich will von unser Vektor a kleinem Feig, wo seinen mir verfolgen. Sei moecha, wo seinen mir verfolgen.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.